Paul Chambers and the Paul Chambers Quintet with I Heard That. It's from his 1959 album, Go. Paul Chambers, a virtuoso jazz double bassist, died on January the 4th, 1969, of tuberculosis. He was just 33 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we should be talking still about issues that matter to us. And I feel a real need for us to do that and to get real to the quality of life that we are facing, largely due to flaws and gaping wounds in our own communities. What is it that we should be so inordinately besieged by these kinds of crimes? And is it not, as I contend, is it not also, apart from the other things that we've talked about, is it not also about the fact that we've let a lot of things go in the name of, it's the outside world that is causing a lot of the problems. So no matter what the problem is, as we identify it, we also refuse to lay the blame where it rightfully belongs. We refuse to criticize what's going on in our communities. We let a lot of stuff go. And the cumulative effect is we have a number of communities that are completely out of whack, out of control, because the people are out of control. And we have never, ever forced the issue of why is it that our communities are falling apart? All communities have contradictions, internal contradictions. All communities have flaws. But what is there some special hesitancy about saying what's wrong in our communities? Who is doing stuff that is causing all of us to suffer? And suffer in a way that is not easily it's not easily fixed. Yes, we know there's white supremacy. Yes, we know about the yawning gap between rich and poor. Yes, we know about the long-standing racial divide in this country. But we also have demonstrable proof that it wasn't always so within our communities, as oppressed as they were. We had people who still held to time-honored codes of conduct. We didn't have this wholesale, do whatever you want, disrespect whomever you want, you make your laws the way you want. We never had that. And why should we think that it is in the interest of the system to shore up what the people in these communities, what they want? Our communities are essentially laissez-faire, do whatever you want to do, communities, because that further helps to eradicate them. Most people just can't get up and move, and most people don't want to get up and move. They like where they live. They want to remain where they live. They're not a people who just pack up and go. They don't have it like that. So wherever they are, they have to make it work. But we have a tidal wave of renegades. And we've got to face this honestly. We have people working night and day to force fragmentation of our communities, to instill fear, to take away people's rights to a decent, peaceful life. They're dealing already with the extraordinary pressures of the world that we know that have been historic and historical. They, you know, people don't want black people to have decent housing, own homes, and have, even with their less than ideal jobs, they have the grounding from their parents. You save, you do the best you can, you maintain, you stay. But we have a growing faction within our communities, and they're almost in every single community that you can think of, who will not abide by anything that they consider rules that curtail their activity. They are gangsters, they're thugs, they're criminals, and they like it like that. They want it like that. And they can only thrive in communities that succumb to these so-called values. We have allowed in our communities this kind of lawlessness not only to prevail, but to grow. And we give reinforcement to that notion that they, the smaller minority, that they can have their way because they've intimidated everybody into obedience and silence and looking the other way as they suffer. I'm not oblivious to the fact that the fear factor is real. I mean, we saw not too long ago in Jamaica, where a small group literally accounted and were at the center of a gunfight that claimed more than 75 lives. These are black people. And there's no reasoning with them. There's no reasoning, there's no understanding about what they're doing, not only having impact immediately, but having impact in the long run. And how dare we point a finger at the outside world, which is accustomed to assailing our communities with violence of all sorts, economic violence, social violence, educational violence, employment violence. How dare we point a finger outward and say, they are the reason our communities are out of order. They are the reason why things are going wrong. And we blithely excuse the criminality, the undesirable people in our neighborhoods who are making it bad for everybody. And the more leeway they believe they have, the more brazen they are about testing their power. You know, you move into a neighborhood, or you've been living in a neighborhood for a long time, and, you know, this is home. You don't envision home being run by drug dealers and by pimps and by people who choose to do whatever they want to do at whatever time they wish to do it. That was my first experience in America. My very first experience. I was so happy to know that I was going to be living with an aunt whose memory preceded my, whose memory of her preceded my actual coming to the United States. I remember this picture vividly. She sent a picture of herself. She is long deceased now. And she had on what I would consider a very nice dress. And what she considered a house dress. But she had a broom in her hands. And she was on the stoop of her brownstone, which was on Monroe Street in Bedford-Stuyvesant. The picture had a sepia tone to it, a kind of brownish tint to it. It was, even in those days, it struck me as being just gorgeous. I couldn't wait to get here. I got here. Okay. And I'm standing on the stoop that I saw where my aunt was with her broom. And I got to learn that that was a ritual on the block, which was mostly brownstones. There was only one house that was a clapboard house, but every other house on the block was a brownstone. And these were working people. I wouldn't describe them as middle class. These were working people. My aunt worked in the post office. And that's what enabled her to buy her brownstone. But we had neighbors, people who worked in civil service jobs, people who had been in the army and got out, people who were retired, but who had extraordinary pride because the brownstones symbolized an accomplishment for them. So every effort was made. There was a strong block association. Every effort was made to keep the block spick and span, clean, well manicured. The yards were very, very well tended to. And it was not at all unusual to see people sweeping the sidewalk and taking care of their properties. Which for me was a very traditional value. Coming from the Caribbean, from Trinidad, that's what you do. You got to keep your backyard clean, your front yard extra clean. You have to keep your property up. Well, the clapboard house that I referred to earlier was eventually sold. I think the people died or transferred the property or whatever happened to it. But there was a new owner. And what do you know? Except for that house, the entire block was clean and in good order. He moved in, and we soon came to know he was a pimp. And that house was immediately transformed into a whorehouse. And then came the all-day, all-night partying. And by the way, that house was directly across an elementary school. And he was also selling drugs. And we started seeing zombies on the block, people zonked out of their minds. The block was quiet except for that house. And everything bad came out of that house. The block association filed complaints with the police. The police literally, the station house was literally around the corner. But they couldn't see what was wrong. We had then kind of a push beyond what they were normally doing, which everybody found reprehensible. Then the owner pimp of the house, or the pimp owner of the house, started pushing his luck with neighborhood girls, trying to recruit them. And then it started to spread like a virus. This one house that was the epicenter of all this nonsense going on, you know, people's houses were burglarized, and we had a problem with parking, people double parking. There were no rules. And then came the gunfights. It was not unusual after a certain while to hear guns going off in that house. And then we saw a body or two coming out of that house, and it's a whole team of police, but the house still stayed on the block. And no matter what the resident did to get that house blocked up, nothing ever happened. And little by little, the people who were proud homeowners on that block sold their homes and moved away, or just moved away, leaving many on the block. Now, why is this important? It is the story of many of our communities. We are invaded by people who look like us, and they decide there are no rules. They're running things by intimidation, by fear, by whatever they think would work, and sink everybody into a kind of silent pact, like you don't see what's going on. You refuse to see what's going on. The police are no help. And that's how our neighborhoods are destroyed. And apart from the physical destruction, you have the psychological destruction, and you have a kind of a destruction we can't easily describe. You have people, like I said, this pimp man, this pimp homeowner on the block, started going after young girls in our neighborhoods. So there is no consciousness there about what they're doing and what the consequences are of what they're doing. And we have lived as hostages, many of us. Many communities are hamstrung because people who look like them are doing this kind of damage to them. So when we hear, as we did in this Chicago, we hear scores of people being shot at, so many people wounded, so many people killed in one fell swoop. It is not just a sudden thing. It is a gradual buildup on both sides. We have people who refuse to accept this kind of lifestyle, but they seem unable to reverse it or to get rid of it. And on the other side, we have people who understand implicitly how good violence is to their plans, their objectives, which is to rule by fear some geographic area where they are declared the rulers. This is obscene. but it is real. And we have to face it. We have to face it. Many of our communities are being governed by people who do not deserve any respect at all, because they don't respect the people that they live close to. They don't respect their standards. They don't respect their histories at all. They don't respect themselves. So we have a blow up, as we saw in Chicago this past weekend, last weekend. And then, you know, it vanishes from the news. But we know the problem is there. And we know they won't go away. And we know that this is not just young people involved. Many of them have already been sanctioned, have already been given legitimacy by their elders. So the question still remains, what do we do? This isn't just a small problem in our communities. This is an omnipresent, almost universal problem in our communities. The values that used to sustain us no longer exist. And we're living in this artificial world governed by artificial so-called values. But people have, some people, have the power and authority to make them standing values, to force us to change our ways, our beliefs, our customs, and even our history and our heritage. So it becomes a crisis now. It is no longer about, well, we have a bunch of gangsters and they're fighting another bunch of gangsters. It is now about the consequences of this kind of pathological behavior that breeds more pathological behavior. And these pathological behaviors being enshrined as normal. And after a while, we will find out there is nowhere else to go. It is not like, okay, we don't like this area, we'll just move. Where are you going to move to? Where are you going to move to? When you have to take into consideration the expenses of a move, the disruption of a move. You're not inclined to move. You're inclined to submit. You're inclined to go along, to get along. And that's where many of our communities are, living day to day in extraordinary stress and fear. And desperate, because they don't see any way out. This pathology becomes the community's norm. And people can say, well, you should just move. You should just get out. They don't understand the realities of life for most Black folks, most poor folks. In your normal life, you would not associate with these thugs, people who have no value for their own lives, let alone yours. But look, You have to live with this and accommodate this every single day. In most housing projects, everybody knows instantly whether you are a stranger or not, i.e., whether you are a prospect or not to be robbed in the hallway. Is that a way to live? But that's the way a lot of people are living. You dare not come home after attending a late event somewhere without trepidation as to whether you would even reach your front door. There are people who are accommodating this. And this has become the way of life for everybody. So we see the deterioration in standards by the people committing these kinds of acts, and we see the concomitant result of people who wouldn't think of living this way, having no choice but to live this way. You see? So that's why we have to talk about it. That's why this should create a sense of urgency in all of our communities to get somewhere with this discussion of who ultimately is responsible for this kind of condition in our neighborhoods. And the system isn't hurried to do anything about it. It's working fine. It's accomplishing the mission. It is systematically emptying neighborhoods. It is systematically disemboweling these neighborhoods of the little bit of commerce that goes on there. It has embedded in the hearts of everybody a sense of fear, so that there is only the desire to get out. When you get out, you lose your land. You lose your space. And that's exactly what they want. Have we not covered enough of this problem as exhibited in Detroit, in Michigan as a whole, in New York City, in Chicago? A lot of the emptying of these once great cities has to do with the fact that the lawless group has been aided and abetted in their lawlessness against all other people because of fear of reprisal, and because the police and law enforcement, they see no reward in instilling those values that have to do with what people want, what they're entitled to as a member of a neighborhood. The approach of the system is, let's get these places emptied, but let's not do it in a way where people can point fingers and say, we did it. No. We had to react because, after all, things were totally out of control in these neighborhoods. We had to impose all kinds of rules we normally wouldn't impose, because these people would not behave, and now everybody gets lumped together. We have tolerated bad actors among us for way too long. We haven't said anything. And for us, it's an easier way out to point to, quote, the system, say, well, the system did it, when in fact we have families and members of the community, influential members of the community, aiding and abetting the situation as it is. They've lost hope. They've lost even pride. They've lost a sense of responsibility. They've lost leadership. And essentially, they're just going along until the other shoe finally drops. We can save ourselves. And we should not hesitate to say that this kind of life is not what we had imagined. It is not what our leaders had imagined. It is not what our forebears had imagined. And we reject it. We disown it. We want nothing to do with that. And we want those people who make a living that way, who feel that it is their right to live that way, even if it takes the right away of other people, most everybody else, to live a decent life. They don't care. What will make these folks care? And what will make the folks who are subjugated to this kind of life every single day, what would it take to make them take a stand that our communities matter? You talk about Black Lives Matter, well, our communities matter. And when people function in such a consistently negative way in our communities, we have to stand up and say, not here. Look, New York City is home to some of the biggest gangs and gangsters in the world. But I dare you to go anywhere where these folks live and see evidence of them living a lawless life in the open. No way. No way. You will find meticulously manicured homes. You will find a quiet neighborhood that looks like it observes the basic rules. You will see orderliness. You will not see a hint of gangster behavior because they're not going to put up with it. Why is it that in our neighborhoods, it is understood that it is the other way around? Good people have to be prepared to live according to gangster rules, because those are the rules. You're not going to come in here in our neighborhood and think that, well, at 8 o'clock, your kids ought to be way into their homework. You're not going to start talking that bougie stuff. We don't like bougie stuff. So you're going to have to go the way we want it to go. We have parties that never end. We have shootings all the time over some stupid stuff. We kill each other because you're wearing the wrong colors. We have no regard. The elderly are as good a target as anybody else. There is nothing we fear, not even death, So what are we going to do? I ask, what are we going to do? And when are we going to own up to the fact that all the other things notwithstanding, the most glaring problem that we have in our communities is that we tolerate this and have been tolerating it for a long time, and we have accepted it as a way of life. Black people doing this to other black people. This is the violence. So let us not start pointing fingers outward. Chicago is telling us it's time to point the fingers right back at ourselves. We'll take this break and come back to your thoughts right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's time for your phone calls and your thoughts. We're looking here. I don't want us to go wading back into those waters of what the system is doing. It has always been doing what it's doing, and it will continue doing what it's doing. I'm trying to get us to understand that within all this stuff, we still have the problem of why are we ceding power? CEDING. Why are we ceding power that we have that puts us in charge in our communities? Lincoln from Mount Vernon, you're on the air.
Hi, good day, Eutrice.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Wonderful topic. I think that I was taking some notes as I was listening to you, and let me see what I want to say. You said, what will make these folks care? That question struck me. And then I thought about supposing a Malcolm X, who was once pimp and who was once into, gangster life, did not encounter someone, a catalyst, when he was in prison. Because if he did not encounter that person who pulled his coat, most likely he would have come back out of prison continuing the same thing he went in there for. And as I look at our problem, and I'm not trying to evade it or excuse it, because I've been a victim, I've been talk about gunpoint. One time a person was trying to rob me, and so happened that the gun jammed when he was trying to shoot me. Several times it was been shot at and all like that when I was minding my own business, So, but that's still, and I know when things like that occur, one could become very subjective and become angry and say, oh, I hate my black people because they're this and that. But as I look at the problem, I see that things have been compounding. I mean, when you think of the two black, or the several black communities, like the Black Wall Street, and there was this other one down in Durham, North Carolina, Haiti, and all like that, where black people were they were literally doing something wonderful for the people, for themselves. And then that was destroyed. And when I say the problem has been compounded, we must remember after the
But Lincoln, you're already way down history lane. I'm saying, do you or do you not accept that within our communities, and this has been going on for a long time, we have a criminal element that, in fact, has taken over and forced the rest of the community. So, you know, I understand and appreciate the historical references, but I'm trying to get us to deal with the question as it exists now.
And that's what I was getting to. My answer is this. We have to take a systematic approach. Like when someone goes to jail, if, say, we design prisons to be rehabilitative, recognizing that many of the people who are in jail are there as a result of something. They're not just there because they were born devils. I mean, all these people, black people who are shooting up each other, they were born into something. And they didn't come out of their mother's womb as devils. Something led them to become that. And one of the things that have led us to become that, for example, back in the time of, say, Langston Hughes, etc., there were black people who were working for the good of all of us. Presently, we are living in a system where it is survival by any means necessary. Yes, I live in a neighborhood where, you know, it's a suburban neighborhood where the black, our neighborhood looks wonderful. You know, I mean, all the black people, our neighborhood is so good, white people running to be part of our neighborhoods again, because our neighborhoods even look better than some of their neighborhoods, you know. However, we are existing in a period where it is due for myself. It's all about me, and even trying to make that enemy at any cost.
Yeah, but you're not putting us close to the question. The question is, we have bad people who have now taken hold, put themselves in charge of what happens in the neighborhood, whether people want it to happen or not, and it isn't. In their criminality that we see the immediate effect. You know, it doesn't take much for anybody to see the progression over the years of how neighborhoods are transformed. We are living, unless people have been, you know, they've been asleep, we're living in a race-based society. All right, we get that. I'm asking, how do you abate the enormous violence by a small group of people in living among us that would basically control the entire neighborhood? What do you do?
I think it has to be a combination of things. We have to get the law involved. Like, for example, if someone is committing crime, if you can apprehend them, apprehend them. But while you're doing this, realize that we are dealing with people with a problem, with an ailment, especially a psychological problem. So I'm not saying that
this is not a psychological problem, because they're not doing this to everybody. They're not choosing to run all over the city doing this to all kinds of people. No, they're very systematic. Their violence is directed at their own. That's what they're doing. Their destruction is directed at their own. If they were prone to violence, any kind of violence, anywhere, okay, we'll see evidence of that. But that's not the evidence we're seeing. We're seeing that they're reserving their most destructive violence for their own. How do you fix that?
It's just like taking an aspirin to get rid of a headache. It's one thing to take an aspirin and say, okay, I'll silence the headache momentarily. And I'm saying to you that there is a reason why their violence is directed to
themselves. There's a reason for everything, Lincoln. And there's a reason for this, too. I'm sure. The question is, you haven't addressed my question. You keep telling me about the reasons. We're done with that right now. We're done with the reasons. We are assuming there are reasons. But whatever the reasons, how do we fix this problem?
We need a hands-on approach. Say you set up centers in the community, and we make the police presence very, very present, very, very visible. But we make the police presence visible with people of their own kind, and let those people of their own kind be educated to deal with them not only as criminals, but as also a diamond in the rough. So, okay, we make the police presence be very, very, I mean, extremely conspicuous and in great magnitude. So when, and to the point that these people realize that there are consequences if they shoot up, etc. But when we apprehend them, we apprehend them with the intention that, okay, we are going to institutionalize them in a sense in which it's going to be rehabilitative. And we should set up a thing where if we see houses are broken down, and if people who are living violent lives are living in those houses, we make it mandatory that these houses be repaired, not only by them, but also by the community.
You at least put an idea on the table, but I'll tell you, the folks that you're talking about, they have become accustomed over several decades to the lives that they're living, and they now choose to live these different ways because the lives that they're living, in their view, it's now for now. They get money now. They get power now. They're realizing their hope for, quote, leadership, as they define it, right now. This rehabilitation thing is not going to appeal to them at all. Thank you, though. It was a good idea. West from New York, you're on the air.
Hello. Can I be heard?
Hello. Yes.
Thank you, Catrice, for taking my call. And, say hello to your audience.
Thank you so much.
As I listen to your discussion with Lincoln,
yes.
You're probably going to be frustrated with me because I'm finding myself sort of the caboose of what he was talking about. But if I could, if you give me an opportunity. You said yesterday, maybe the day before, to go back and lend an ear to Amos Wilson. So I took the opportunity to listen to Amos, and a very curious thing happened. You had a caller yesterday who referenced Neely Fuller's book and, you know, the work that he's done. And here we are in this situation again. So I just wanted to see if I could articulate something. I've been arguing with young black boys and girls for years about being equal opportunity destroyers. And they don't understand the concept. You can't sell drugs in suburban neighborhoods effectively because law enforcement is going to keep you from doing that. They're going to contain you where you live. So they're okay with you destroying those areas where black people live and brown people live, but it's not okay for you to do that in the areas that cross that border. So you cannot be an equal opportunity destroyer. You've got to buy into my people are worthless. My people have no value. You don't mind if I do these things to my people. If you multiply that or you exponentially expand on that, then you can see there's a hopelessness involved in it. These kids feel that no one loves them and they don't love anybody. The other thing, and I believe this sincerely, these are the children who are victimized by the war on drugs. Now, some of them may be as old as 35 or 40, but that's how long this war on drugs has been going on. Many of these kids grew up in homes destroyed by policy, created by politicians to place their family members in greater confinement. Now, I use that because in this day and time, we're looking at young rural boys and girls who are probably white or white identified that are caught up with the methamphetamines and they're caught up with drugs. And the world has taken note of that and said we need to treat these people humanely. We need not break up these families. We need to support these families because if these men and women, these white men and women go to jail, their children will have no one. No one took that position in the war on drugs. So we now have the consequences of that. Kids who love no one but those closest to them. And those closest to them have the same experience that they have. And now we're looking at an outcome that could have been predicted. As a matter of fact, Amos Wilson did predict it. And it's exactly what he said it would be. We are killing one another indiscriminately because we hate the face in the mirror. Now, I am bothered
by
this.
But here's the thing I want to ask you and challenge you on this. And I do not refute what you've just said. It's valid. But here's a question. Why are we accepting this rationale, in a sense, as the reason we can't do anything about it? We had people who were before us in the Prohibition era. It was alcohol. Did all black communities fall apart because of alcohol? No. But we had the sway still of old-fashioned values. You have a job. You feed your family. You take care of your children. You see to your community. You participate somehow in the building, not destruction, but the building of your community. You take pride in the accomplishment of things that the community shares as a project that they put together and executed together.
Right. Well, so, Eutresa, I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying so
you're getting ready
to respond.
What I would say is that, in fact, in the 1910s, 20s, 30s, 40s, there were probably differing opinions in the black collective. I'm not assuming that W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington always agreed. I know that Marcus Garvey and W.E.B. Du Bois did not agree. I know that as we move forward, there were those who disagreed with A. Philip Randolph and those who disagreed with the March on Washington. I'm familiar, for instance, with Condoleezza Rice's father, John Rice, and how he stood on things down in Birmingham in those days. The divisions that have sometimes been used to manipulate and create diversion from the collective point of view have always been there. Jobs.
All right. I've just been given a notice. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have to end it here because of time. Let's continue this conversation a little further tomorrow. And thank you so much for your participation and sharing your very profound thoughts today. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.